Yeah, like I said, please keep, please feel free to keep doing this throughout the panel. I'm going to throw out my tomato, talk about Hootsuite, and then we'll start. But I wanted to kick off with a case study, and Brian, I'm going to throw to you because I know a lot of the inspiration for this panel, and Matt can correct me if I'm wrong, but was a live event that happened at CGI and how you guys had to delineate between all this mass of wonderful content and how to tell a story. So can you maybe, Matt as well, can you guys throw in, give us a case study so we can kind of lay the groundwork for a lot of what we're going to talk about today?
Sure. So I'll start with a little bit of background. Last year, President Clinton thought that CGI should apply what is a global model to the U.S. and specifically to job creation. So we had an event called CGI America, which was a couple days of really intense working sessions with a lot of actually groups that are here. Startup America was one of sort of the people who curated one of our working rooms. But the goal of it was to come out of the event with specific cross-sectoral partnerships that would help make the right kind of jobs in the U.S. So sort of high level and wonky, and we approached this meeting and approached sort of the media around it without really a lot of, not preparation, but a lot of real experience in this area. We didn't know what would resonate, what would be the good points to pull out. We had some very interesting panels that had everyone from Rahm Emanuel to Governor Jennifer Granholm, but really didn't know what would resonate with the audience in our sort of final highlights video that we wanted to make for more of a public audience. So we worked with Matt, and we actually decided that instead of us trying to figure out what people would be responsive to, we should maybe follow the Twitter conversation around our hashtag and see just what quotes, what moments, what speakers people were really interested in. And we started that with more of a, I think, an idea of just trying to get a feel for what people were responding to. What we found out, though, is that, you know, through the like, sort of mass of tweets that we received, we actually had sort of a rough time code of the best moments in the room. So it went from less from, you know, there was a really good quote from President Clinton at X moment that 20 people tweeted to, you know, we actually have our 10 moments from the meeting that we now just can put together very quickly. And we literally released the video on YouTube the night of the last day of the meeting.
Yeah, it was. It showed on the afternoon of the third day and included footage from that morning. And we had only one assistant editor to make this, which was arguably understaffed. But what we found was that we had a room full of assistant editors who were tweeting us the things that we should be pulling and using in the closing video. And it was a great success because the people who were watching the film had helped create it. And we're trying to recreate that here very quickly. But so yeah, that was kind of the inspiration for the idea behind this panel. How quickly can we crowdsource feedback and how quickly can we affect the creative content that we're putting out in the world based on that?
And also, I'm sorry, just add one more thing is that one of the reasons why this worked for us and why we did it was because we're a nonprofit, we're on a shoestring budget. And I'm sure a lot of people in this room in the creative world are used to people telling you to, you know, do things as cheaply as possible. But we really didn't have the ability to, you know, have directors or assistant editors in every room listening to all of the content, processing it for us. So we did this out of necessity, and that's kind of why it worked and why we continue to do it for our events.
Was your hashtag like shit world leaders say? Or was
no,
your hashtag?
It was not.
Oh, okay. A little more official in that room, understandable. Yeah. No, but thank you guys. It's a great way to lay out a lot of what we're talking about today. And Mark, I want to go to you, and then Sally, I'll go to you. But Mark, knowing you have all these amazing brand clients out in the audience, obviously, having worked with a lot of brands myself, you know, when you say things like, hey, we're going to do live tweeting where we are editing in the fly, there's a lot of legal concerns, privacy concerns, messaging concerns. How did you, can you give a case study or just talk about like a framework that you can set up for a brand or a client, maybe if it's not a brand, to make them be comfortable with this sort of storytelling milieu?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for your example, it worked really well because it was a live event. Brands don't always have that opportunity. So for brands, it's just the notion of letting real people dictate what might be the final version of a video that plays or a piece of film, and that's a scary place for many brands. But it's kind of, I'm inspired by it because it's really moving in that direction, and I think it requires brands and agencies to get less comfortable working off of a storyboard with exactly what we're going to shoot, and more talk about an idea or an emotion that we want to capture and then be listening through, you know, YouTube analytics, and hopefully they're going to get better and better and give us more and more information. But letting consumers control what that final video might be. And, you know, we were talking about this yesterday, this notion that with brands, you shoot a video and you launch it, and it's pretty much dead. I mean, people can watch it and see it, but it's kind of done, or it's stuffed,
it's in the
so
can,
to speak.
Yeah.
Yes, it's in the can. And changing that, like, videos should stay alive. It should never end. And if you are open to shooting extra stuff at the time that you're actually sitting down and shooting it, or getting the cameras back out and shooting things based off of what you're hearing, that video can stay alive and be much more reflective of what consumers want. And, you know, it requires creative directors and editors and directors and brand managers to sort of get to a place where they're like, we might not be the authority on what what is the best video. And again, that requires a change in the way that we approach things right now. And that's exciting.
No, thank you. And again, the hashtag there is like shit the Snuggles Bear would say.
Yeah.
Is that,
because
he's edgy.
I like
Bear's
that.
Bear's edgy.
Yeah.
And if the Snuggles folks are here, I know that's not They're really not the hashtag. Right. And there's my career. Sally, I wanted to kick to you in terms of, you have a really interesting and important part of this panel in the sense of a lot of the technology. This is a two-part question. Mm-hmm. One is, can you tell folks some of the technology that's going to affect real-time video editing? And then maybe I'll interrupt you and ask a second question. But then I'm wondering then how that will affect the sort of objectivity of how storytelling is both told and interacted with. So again, those two questions for you.
So I think what we're seeing is just the amount of processing that the technology can do, the next generation semiconductors can do. We've seen sort of the beginning with the Kinect box, which is very basic, but now can actually watch your gestures. But going forward, it's going to be very easy to track your eyeball movement, see how your eyes dilate over different images, see how long you stare, your facial expressions. That's all going to be able to be tracked. And so what I think can happen going forward is it's going to become less about tweeting and more about, you know, your responses, uncontrolled responses, actually being documented and actually watched as you're watching video, so that they can actually determine, you know, what brands you most associate with, what types of video you like and you don't like. And one of the interesting things about that is, does that change the message when you actually don't get to control the message in your tweet? So is it a different message that comes out in terms of your like or dislike of the video that you're seeing?
Just to add to that, is that a whole element, a little bit off topic, but social TV, is that also, or is that more quote broadcast format versus a video format? Meaning, can somebody be watching a show, you see where their eyes are on screen, you can connect?
So I think it depends on where the technology is adopted, but all chips eventually, I think, in TVs and even in your smartphone will eventually have the ability to track all of your, you know, expressions, where your eyes are looking, maybe even your temperature. And you're not talking, you know, 20 years away. You're probably talking about increments over the next 5 to 10 years of being able to do that. Even the next Kinect box probably will move to the stage where they're starting to watch your eyes movement in the same time as your gestures.
That's awesome. And I'll come back to you about the objectivity. Yeah. Stuff. And this is not the same type of thing, but CNN, I think, I read this thing about apps now for folks who are clinically depressed. They can start to analyze through semantic tact different words that you're saying, so that after a while, if they sense that you're depressed, you can actually get texts from your support group. So anyway, all these different ways that we're sort of getting analyzed. Let me go now to Matt and ask this. You know, working with brands or working with other stakeholders, maybe it's an organization like a Clinton, like a CGI. How do you tell a story and, quote, remain objective? And obviously you guys have this wonderful expertise in branded documentary. So what does the word objective mean when, in one sense, you're asking people to be a real part of the process and help edit, as it were?
Well, I mean, from our end, objective is a hard thing to define, especially in documentary, which is the format that we work in. I mean, you have... Say you're making a 1 hour film, you have 120 hours of footage to choose from. There's an infinite number of permutations that could come out of that. So I think that there's a couple of guidelines that we go by, and one of which is that we never do anything that's not true or that is a distortion of the truth. And I think there's just a real objectivity there that's very important with documentary, especially when you get into the branded space, because there's some conflict of interest there. And I think we've been able to do that because we work primarily on these cause programs, and we work on cause programs that are actually doing good, so we don't have to fudge them. But then there's a really subjective part, which is we try to make the thing that we think is best and the most compelling, the most engaging, and that will, you know, hold people's attention the most. Now you get this, when you bring somebody else or a whole group of people into this feedback loop, I think there's a balancing that has to happen between, because they're not objective either. I mean, they're bringing in their own standpoints on the film and what they think of the content. So I think really what it's giving you is just a very large swath of other people's subjective opinions that you can then kind of try to merge with your own in a way that creates something that you still feel is true and you still feel is compelling, but also loops in and integrates this huge group of feedback that you've gotten from, you know, a lot of people. And I think, Sally, what you're talking about is really interesting. Actually reading people's body movements, that's probably a lot closer to objective than you know, their tweets, because everybody's got a Twitter personality and a Facebook personality and all that sort of thing. So I think, I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you didn't. I have a follow-up for Mark, but then Brian, too, throw in if you want. But truth can be tough to define. I mean, truth means one thing to one person, and I want to make this from a brand standpoint. I'm leading you a little bit. But is transparency part of that truth? Meaning a brand may say, well, this is our truth, but hey, world, just so you have a framework, this is what we mean. Is that something you recommend in terms of, you know, the word truth? Again, I'm just digging into that term. So that then when a format is set up for crowdsourcing or what have you, people just understand kind of how they're supposed to respond. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think truth and transparency change from brand to brand, and a lot of it's based on, you know, what your brand stands for. What I think we're getting at is our role in this place, you know, and I mean, if you do this too much, you'll very quickly get into watching home videos pretty much. So someone's got to have a filter or, you know, a playground in which you can ask people to play in. And I think that it's a curated conversation that I think that the brand can have some control over, but it needs to be opened up enough so that people can have their own take on it. And that, again, that's a fine line, and different brands are going to open up that transparency at different rates. You know, I think the best ones are opened as far as they can.
And by that, I mean, just a couple of tips. Can you throw in a couple of tips for folks? So that would that be things like on your Facebook page saying, email here, you know, we have to, these are going to be, these comments will be screened, whatever words, can you give a couple of tips?
Well, I mean, you know, in the social space, if you ask anybody to do anything on, I mean, you know, we manage a lot of our clients' social experiences, and we find that some of the best status updates are always when we do an open-ended question and ask them something. It's incredible. I mean, you don't even have to, like, go into any detail. Just, you know, I spend a lot of time working on cats. I said it. And they're big on the internet, if you haven't heard. And, you know,
like the musical? Or?
Yeah. So Cat Chow is one of my clients, and we posted one yesterday, and it was literally a cat sitting on a keyboard, and it just said, like this if this has ever happened to you. And we had something like 5,000 likes in 45 minutes. I mean, so you don't want to be too prescriptive and give them too clear of a direction. The comments that come from that is amazing, you know. So to create a video and ask them to play back what they think at a high level, enough of a playground to keep it focused, but not too much that people opt out and they're unable to put their own stamp on it is what I would recommend.
Cool. There's a claws joke there, like a cat's claw. I'm not going to say it, although I technically just did say it.
So
I slipped it in.
Wow.
Brian, let me ask up, though, truth. I mean, obviously, this is my preference, so help me here. Clinton Global Initiative, I may want to know, what is your take on a subject? What is your, or what is an organization's political leaning? And so it's sort of like, this again, a preference. I don't mind if someone says, I'm going to be subjective, this is why we started this organization, here's what we're going to say. Does that help then an audience know where you're coming from, or do you see that as dangerous with the work you do?
Well, I think there's a couple different levels to our organization that might come into play in that question. I mean, specifically, the work we do at our meetings is highly curated as it is. I mean, these are speakers and members that we've chosen to spotlight, programs we've chosen to talk about, challenges we've decided to discuss. And so all of the content that you would have for something like this is something that has already gone through, you know, our personal subjectivity for what we think will be sort of the best event, the best sort of program we can put together. I think, though, that there's a second part to that, which is, I think when you open it up to the crowd, sort of coming off Matt's point a little bit.
Skydiving into my point.
Yes, skydiving into Matt's point.
It's actually breakdancing.
Actually, I might disagree with Matt a little bit here, which is that I think that when you open up to the crowd, you do become more objective in some ways, in that let's take, and I was trying to think of a good political example of this or non-political example. Let's say we were to make a video about, or any piece of content about the music festival. And let's say Matt is a big fan of some, and Matt's our director, and let's say Matt's a big fan of some very small, not very good artist. He might want to put that artist first and foremost in the video, but everyone else might say, like, no, it's Jay-Z, who everyone liked, and there was this great moment. He played that one song whose name I can't say 10 times. Like, let's say that's what people actually want to see, and so then you take your director out of it, which goes to Mark's point a little bit, too, is that, you know, your creatives have to, in a lot of ways, be courageous enough to take themselves out of the equation, mm-hmm. but that inevitably you will get a product that I think is more objective, at least to, I mean, I think it's easier to be objective in that sense as opposed to just having it in sort of the hands of one or two creatives.
Or like a larger group of subjective opinions more closely approximates what is objectively good than what a few.
Yes, exactly.
I think there's danger in that, though.
Yeah.
I heard a speaker one time say that everybody in this country has a PhD when it comes to watching TV or a movie, and we do. I mean, we spend a lot of time doing it, so, you know, you have to listen to that collective wisdom, and it is wisdom. I mean, some of it's crazy, but a lot of it is wisdom.
Yeah, I want to dig into that in a minute, because wisdom, again, I'm not trying to be like semantic guy, but that's kind of what we're talking about here. But I did want to ask Sally, knowing that all the technologies here and that the implementation of the tech, I know, is your expertise, mm-hmm. but I'd love to hear your thoughts on how is the nature of the work that you're doing going to frame or change objectivity? You know, if the first person that puts a video out there and almost immediately starts to get changed, the companies you're talking to, for instance, to purchase the technology, do you give them any advice on how this, and I know some of it's early, but how this will affect how they frame their storytelling and still sort of have a brand voice, et cetera?
Well, we're way down the food chain, so we're not advising at that level, but I think the reality is for people developing video, there is going to be with the new video search capability and what you can do, so the ability for consumers to change the stories. And so, you know, how are you going to control that? Definitely on the advertising side, people are going to know if they're how their brand is being looked at on a real-time basis, how long you're, you know, looking at that Coke bottle, depending on who's standing beside it and not standing beside it. You know, they're going to be able to substitute brands in quickly if that's not doing well, or change the person who's holding that brand at that time. So I think it opens up a lot of opportunities. It also opens up a lot of challenges, especially on, you know, how do you control your artistic talent and value and everything else, and do you allow people to real-time edit what they're seeing and change it on the go, or do you say, no, as an artist, this is my piece, and you can't be part of that. And I think that it's going to be a lot easier than we can actually realize. If you just try to sit back and think about where video is today from 10 years ago, and how we access it everywhere and how freely, you know, we can even make changes now and send stuff back and forth. Just imagine where it's going to be 10 years from now and how quickly it's going to be able to, they're going to suck all this information in from you as an individual, reprocess it, and then maybe change the content while you're watching it.
What I think is interesting about what Sally's been talking about, which is also kind of terrifying. But what's interesting is that there's no barrier to entry. And I think that, you know, that is a big issue. And we've seen it as well. It's difficult for people. It's not difficult, but there's a barrier to entry for people to tweet what they like about a commercial. Most people just naturally won't. I think in this room, it'd be funny to sort of see how many people actually use the hashtag and how many people actually tweeted, because we told you to, but even then, probably only half the room might have actually done it, and probably only once. So you're not really getting a huge sample size, really. I mean, I guess relative to the size of the room you are, but we oftentimes ask people questions, and I think that's a general best practice for social media, is to see what your Facebook followers are into, et cetera. And it's we rarely get really on-point responses. But what Sally's talking about, I mean, you could take the temperature of every person in this room, mm-hmm. and they would have, there is literally no barrier to entry for that. And so that is pretty interesting to me, I think.
No, I agree. And I'm a big augmented reality freak. And with like Google goggles coming out, so you could almost literally just see the world that you want to see. And with real-time video also, it's like, if I don't like the video that you're putting out to me or even a live situation, mm-hmm. I can change it on the fly and sort of see what I want. That said, different panel. Matt, I want to ask you a question, which is, let's talk about scripted content versus documentary. It seems like we were talking before in the green room, there's a real opportunity for flexibility of messaging, right? Like certainly it's something like the CGI thing. It's not just, quote, what's the best content? You have tons of material, I'm sure, where you could have been like, here's Clinton's talk, here's this person's talk. So there's a real flexibility of messaging. So can you talk, what's the process of when you have sort of this embarrassment of riches to choose which story to tell?
Right. We work primarily in the documentary format, so I'm going to show my bias a little bit because I think that there's a lot of huge advantages to that. You know, as I talked about earlier, if you get 1 minute of usable footage out of an hour of shooting, you've done pretty well. And for years, that was just basically a frustration for editors because you had all of this extra footage that ended up on the cutting room floor. But now what that is essentially is an asset that gives you tremendous flexibility in recutting and in shifting the media you've created and in helping things never be dead and helping things remain alive. You know, if you find that a character who appears for, you know, with a couple of interview sound bites in a short documentary that people's eyes are dilating when they see that person, well, then you have a two-hour interview with that person, and you can, you know, tweak that and make them a more significant part of the story. So I think there's real advantages that are just intrinsic to the documentary process. You shoot a ton, you have a ton of stuff, you can put more of that stuff in front of people and let them decide what's good. And then as you hear back from them what's good, you have this whole archive of things to work from. I also think it's great. I think that these kind of real stories just play well in the social space because people more and more want to see their brands as people. They want to enter. They want a backstage pass to everything. And I think that the documentary gives you more of that feel of the backstage pass. And especially when you can change it. When you can say, I don't like this part of backstage. Show me a different one.
The videos that I'm most excited about that we're doing for our brands, it's interesting, you know, with the traditional agencies, they tend to be shooting scripted TV spots, and that's great. And then there's the other end of it, which is documentary, which brands seem to do really well in the social good space. That in-between area for the digital folks, where brands aren't quite ready when they're not talking about social good to just let us go off and do a documentary. That would be awesome. But when we think about video, we think about it in a documentary type way. You know, to go back to Catch Out, you know, we just put a video up a little while ago, and it's this rallying cry. You know, we wanted to create a video for cat owners to be proud about being a cat owner, and not because dog owners are cool, but cat owners get kind of a bad rap.
So wait a second, you know, here. That's a little controversial.
Debatable.
That's right.
So we go into this video, and we actually shot it here in Austin. We did like 25 locations in 4 days. It was insane, and some of it was scripted, you know. I want people saying, I am not a crazy cat lady. And if you write the lines right, they really do believe that. And then we wanted, because, why are you a cat person? And we had some lines that we wanted to get, but the best lines, the lines that got in the final thing, were the lines that we just let them go off and tell us why, because they're thinking of things that, you know, we never would have thought of. And that's great. And now that the thing's done, you know, we can go on YouTube and see that our 2-minute video, people tend to start dropping off around 142. So we've either got a bad because there, or maybe our video should only be 142. So, you know, if our brand and our agency is smart, we'll do something about it. Let's say George Clooney's a cat lover and he wants to do something. We could get the sticks out and go shoot him saying something, insert it in. So it's we tend to live in that world halfway between scripted-ish and documentary-ish, and that's exciting. I think being reflective to those edits is a huge opportunity.
Yeah, that's how we actually created the Shit Panelists Say video. I mean, there's hours of stuff that's hopefully less funny than what made it into the final cut, and a lot of that was improvisational. We had some lines that we knew we wanted people to say, but we kind of let people go off and didn't have an order or a script in which they would come. We just put it together at the after we'd shot.
So sort of docu-scripted,
yes.
I'm trying to make up a term. It's going to trend. Let me ask you this then. I'll throw this to whoever wants to do it, because I was going to put it to mainly the three guys. But there's a joke, you know, with video, delivery of video can be cheap, fast, or good, and you tell a client or a director, I can give you two of the three. So obviously that's a challenge when there's time frames, when there's a brand or a client involved. So talk on that for a minute. How do you make those decisions? Or give me a case study of where you had to make a decision. But then just as important, how do you tell the stakeholders who are asking you, your collaborators, why you're making those two out of three choices? So I'll throw that to whoever.
Right. Well, fast is almost a given. So you're basically choosing between cheap and good. But I think that's, you know, that's less and less true. I mean, and some of that is just the development of the video production technology. I mean, you can now shoot something on an iPhone that looks better than what you could shoot on a $50,000 camera not so long ago. I think that, you know, it's funny. It's if something is really topical, I think we're seeing more and more that you can have it not be the most beautifully shot thing that you've ever seen. Just for fun, after Obama sang Al Green, we cut together a thing. There was just some clips of him walking around in slow motion, and I think Newt Gingrich gets glitter bombed in the video. But it was the worst thing that we've ever made, basically. And it, you know, got tens of thousands of views on YouTube because it was up the day after. So, you know, I say that, but I never want to get away from making things that are good, because coming from a filmmaking background, that's always your goal. I think you basically got to, the more topical you can be, almost the less polished it has to be, which people are more okay with because they're getting that backstage pass, I think.
Mark or Brian, you guys have any thoughts on that?
I think that the digital space has redefined good. I mean, it's not beautiful film. I mean, it can be beautiful film, but it's more about content. It's more about what it is you're truly talking about, and that's where it focuses on. So, you know, if you've got a great insight that you want to capture on film, it can be shot on an iPhone and be good. And you're right, it will be fast. It's always fast. I think fast adds energy to it, and that's important. So,
I think I've already shown my bias about this one, but I obviously prefer, you know, doing all three is the best. And I think that what we've realized, not even as a plug or anything, but we do try to find ways to really tell these stories. And what we've found is that it really doesn't matter if something's HD or not. It really is actually the content of it. If you see a woman being empowered in the Middle East, it's more important if that's on a, you know, old camera on a cell phone or whatever, as opposed to being something you shoot HD in a studio somewhere that's just kind of a corporate plug. But yes, what I was thinking about a little bit is, I guess that's the video production element of it, but then there's sort of the creative piece, and I'm not sure that has the same kind of standards, if that is, you know, similarly, you have to be cheap, fast, and good, but I think what we're talking about here in a lot of ways is kind of changing how that creative looks and how the feedback comes, and I think that's an interesting place where you can actually be all three of those things, depending on how much you engage the crowd.
Well, there's good in terms of the content of the piece, and then right. There's good in terms of the production value of the piece. And I think what all of us are kind of agreeing on is the content is king. I mean, something can be gorgeous, and if it's just a bunch of crap, then it doesn't matter. People aren't going to be engaged. But yeah, something beautiful and timely, like the content of it, can be shot on an iPhone and be fantastic.
All right, then I have one more question to follow up on this, and then Sal, I have one last question for you. But where does crowdsourcing, where do you draw the line? You know, I'm playing devil's advocate now, in terms of like when do you, like the wisdom of the crowd, we all have examples of like, we say that, and then in reality, some jerk says some kind of flaming comment, and it takes off, and you're like, wow, the wisdom of the crowds wanted to see that dog chewing his own butt or something. You know? So where do you like draw the line, and how do you have a framework, again, so that you can kind of have curated crowdsourcing, and to talk about that, if you would.
I actually was thinking about this a little bit because I was trying to figure out exactly where there was a place where feedback was already being given and where immediate tweaks need to happen. And I thought of SportsCenter because like those times when you watch an event just ends and you turn on SportsCenter and then they have the highlights from that event up 2 minutes later. And that's obviously a very expensive, fast, good process. But you know, you will know when something either stupid or something really good happens in sports by looking at Twitter, because it will immediately rise to the top. And I'm not sure exactly what the answer to your question is there, but there is that. That's one of those areas where you do have, you're seeing two totally different pieces of content. You know, if a player like hits his head against the rim or whatever and everyone's laughing about it, that'll go up there, just as if Kobe Bryant, the best basketball player in the world, you know, puts up 30 points three games in a row.
Or if Clinton puts up a three-pointer. That's
exactly.
Totally,
yes. Yeah. That's kind of in the in-between space, right?
Okay,
yeah. Anything? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think it varies the extent to which you want to curate and the extent to which you really want to let this crowdsource intelligence guide you. I think it varies based on the medium. I know that, you know, every film that I've ever made that's purely my own pursuit, I've focus grouped it, and a lot of times you get conflicting opinions in the focus group, and then at the end of the day, sometimes you just say, yeah, I think they're wrong, or like maybe they didn't like that part, but it's integral to the story. I think it's a little different story when you're working in the advertising space and with brands. I think that crowd feedback has to play a bigger role in what the final piece is. Again, never getting away from what's true and always employing that in a way that you still feel like you're making something creatively good. But it's, you really got to, you know, take it into heavier consideration, I think.
And Mark, you already kind of said this, but you made a great point, which is you allowed the formatting for crowdsourcing, but then in the case with the cat situation, you actually, the stuff that you couldn't have scripted or didn't script was the stuff that came to
right.
The top anyway.
We one of the interview people we had were two 50-year-old sisters who lived together with two cats, and we got this cut, and
you're making it really hard to not joke, just so you know. I do apologize, too.
This is my life. And and the one looked at the other, and she kind of whispered, "We really are crazy cat ladies." And, like, that's gold. Like, because I know our audience would love that, but I got a brand who just spent 1 hour or a minute and 50 seconds saying that they're not crazy cat ladies. So we're torn. We're trying to figure out, do we put that in, don't we put that in? Well, I mean, we know our audience will love it, but you know, and I'm it's still up, but the video's still live, so maybe we will do that. I don't know.
I hope again, I can't speak for the brand, because I the word crazy, however, from an SEO standpoint, you'd have to deal with that. I can't even imagine.
Right.
But come on, embrace the crazy cat thing. That's awesome. That's
right.
Like a T-shirt I would buy, and I don't have a cat.
Right.
All right. Just so you know, I'm gonna ask one question for Sally, but we love questions. If you guys have any questions, and there's two mics, there's one in the front and one in the back. And if you don't have questions, we'll keep riffing. So yeah, go ahead if you would now, if you have any. I see there's hundreds of people hurling themselves towards the mics. It's after lunch. But if you have questions, just go to the mic so we can catch it for the recording and stuff. But so Sally, again, knowing that you're the tech focus side of this, mm-hmm. but I'd still be interested, rhapsodize for me if you would. Let's say that your technology, of course, is going to totally take hold, mm-hmm. and it's 5 years from now. So just for the fun of it, tell me how the real engagement with that technology is going to change a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, and maybe in ways that you haven't said yet.
Okay. I think, you know, one of the questions that comes to mind is, you know, why would you allow this technology to actually take hold in your home and actually allow people to read your responses? But I think what we've seen, even with Facebook, in terms of people's willingness to put a lot of their personal information out there, and because they want to be part of the process, I actually think people will actually sign up and allow it to happen. So I think, you know, what you could see is it could be a lot more awkward to watch TV with your wife, because she's going to know a lot faster than you'd like her to know where you're responding and where you're not. You're probably going to be able to,
based like when you're coy during the Victoria's Secrets ad, like during Glee, and
that
like,
person's really
totally
telling,
looking at the bed.
Or just saying she's really not that good looking, honey. I you know, really better. I think you're going to see real time the fact that they're going to watch how you react to video, and the video is going to change. It might start changing in terms of the shows over time, but it will get faster and faster, so it will actually even change while you're watching the show. So, you know, you have the Coke bottle. My preference will be, is to see a guy holding something. My husband's will be to see the same guy holding a hot dog, right? But you know, it'll be changed based on our preferences and what we want to see. So you're going to see that kind of advancements. At the same time, I think people are going to really be able to track their advertising dollars. So they're going to know, okay, you know, when that show is being watched, how long you're actually looking at that brand. And they're going to be able to track how you react to it. And so that's going to, I guess, you know, become important to everybody that's making video, especially that is trying to make it and make money associated with brands on it. And I think eventually, you know, at these kind of events, it's really going to become, you guys aren't going to have control of the message because your smartphones will just actually take your feedback and drive it forward. So, you know, you might be out there right now being very, very kind and sitting there through this, but in the future, we would be getting the response of, you know, does this panel suck or does it not suck real time, whether you'd, you know, like to tell us or not. And so there will be benefits to that because I think it'll make people more on point on their messages, and the people who are actually interacting or getting their message out there are going to get paid and rewarded for it, and the other people are going to very quickly move to the side. So I think that those are things that you will see happen.
No, this is fascinating to me. I mean, I used to be an actor, so things like in the afternoon, I knew doing matinees that the audience was going to be quieter because they'd just eaten lunch. So it's a physiological thing. People just had a lot of their blood sugars dropped. When people cough, I didn't mean to point that out, but sometimes repeated coughing, sometimes there's been studies that it shows a type of boredom. I'm not exactly sure why. The doors opening and closing, right? All these data points on top of the eye tracking are going to be things. I'm not saying anything about this panel, mind you, but I'm just saying that that's instant feedback. So along those lines, and again, please, I'm now riffing until you have questions. Where does this like get to be too much? You know, like I know for myself, yes, I'm a PBS nerd, but like, you know, I fell into Downton Abbey. I'll say it. I'm a Downton Abbey guy. Happy to say that. Is he going to love Mary? Ask her to marry you. Anyway, where does some of this become sort of exhausting, you know? And so I'm playing devil's advocate in terms of like the advocate for scripted stuff. And so when a brand comes and says, or an organization, and says, we really want scripted, tell me in this future world, and again, I'm just playing devil's advocate because I see tons of advantages, why you would pitch sticking with a documentary format.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things is the kind of the point that I was trying to make earlier, that people, I think, are yearning, even outside of this ability to shift this kind of content around, I think people are yearning more and more for just real stuff. I think that I'm not a huge reality television fan myself, but I think one of the nice things that it has done is paved the way for wonderful documentaries to be more widely viewed. I think people are more and more used to seeing the real. I think it also taps in, you know, working in the cause space, I think that a lot of brands are finding themselves faced with distrust from their consumers, sometimes earned and sometimes by association. And especially in the cause space, we've seen all these brands who are so worried that if they tell people about the good things that they're doing, even if they're actually good, it'll seem self-serving and it'll completely defeat the purpose of their cause action. And our point is always, well, don't you tell people about the good things you're doing. Go find the people that you've helped and let them tell people about the good things that you're doing. So I think that just from a content perspective, yes, you can change it and you can change this stuff really quickly and it's really malleable content. But I also think that there's an authenticity, to use the horribly overused word, and a genuineness to that content that I think people are wanting more and more and needing more and more because of this kind of underlying distrust of anything big.
Well, all right. Again, I'm just going to push because we had this conversation in the green room. I thought it was fun. And
we do have.
Oh, is there a question?
Yeah.
Oh, thank goodness. We're going to crowdsource your question, so we're interactive. Sorry, go ahead.
All right. So right now, I'll use YouTube as an example. But you upload a video to YouTube, and it's on there, and you can't actually change it once it's uploaded. You can see the stats. You can see where people are not watching anymore. But do you see some point in the near future where either, probably not on YouTube, but some other service will come up where you can actually have a more interactive video that you could mold the video and still keep the same view count and the same URL as you go forward with that?
That's a great question.
I would love that.
And a great suggestion.
I think that's a Sally question. Thank you.
Video search technology is advancing rapidly. And so the ability to go in and actually start to manipulate the video and search through it, edit it, that is coming. Now, the question is when people put up their content, are they going to allow you to actually go and modify their content or not, and how the legal rule is going to evolve. I believe that people that are probably doing their own sort of home videos, et cetera, will allow that. There'll start to be, you know, all sorts of people going in, taking your video, remodifying it, editing it. You know, the Hollywood guys are going to try to keep theirs all, you know, you can't change it. But it's going to become easier and easier to search videos, all the video content that's out there, find different clips that you want, different, you know, expressions, et cetera, and start to modify it all real time. And it's, you know, it's the little kids today that are going to be figuring out how to do that, to sort of how we sort of did the Adobe stuff from way back. It's going to move like that.
But what's your name, by the way? Thank you for your question. I'm sorry. What's your name?
Oh, Gonzalo.
Even taking it a step back, just for the person who put it up to be able to do what you just said, I think would be phenomenal.
Yeah. A lot of brands have done cool mashup stuff too, right? Brands are doing a lot of like make this video your own. So, again, thank you for your question. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
We've done a little bit, I think, on other video services where we've had to make little changes and replace things or, you know, whatever. But I think that there does become an issue. I mean, view counts and everything that you're saying here it's that, you know, if you put up a video and it's of cat owners and it's very nice and people embed it all over the place and it gets 100,000 views and the next day you change it to dog owners, like that's just a different, it's disingenuous. And obviously that's a silly example, but it is disingenuous to change the product, I think, at some point and then, but then keep it living as the original piece, which I guess maybe Matt might have more of an opinion on, but it raises an issue, I think, an ethical issue.
Well, certainly for you, right? If someone has I'm talking to you, Brian, in terms of like a policy, if they say something about policy and then they change it, what's that great site? It's called readmylips.com or something. Have you seen that? Anyway, this one site takes these different political people speaking and they actually dub it with this amazing like gibberish.
Right.
But my point there is that then changes obviously the entire tone of, but I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Matt, you had a response?
No, I think it's a great point. I mean, which is kind of where it's a particularly good point in that branded space. If there is somebody like an organization or a group that is responsible for that content and it changes a lot and, you know, all these people who were viewers before, all of a sudden their view now traveled to something else that they don't like, that's a real problem for a brand, I think. But I think that will always be curated in the branded space. I think that probably will be a problem in kind of, you know, the billions of videos that are just uploaded by users on YouTube every day. I think that will become a problem there, but I'm not really sure what you do about it, because as soon as you allow those videos to be amended, I mean, maybe they can only be amended by the user, but not necessarily with the viewer's permission. I don't really have a good solve for that.
I think maybe as long as you could see the history so you could backtrack. I mean, I've seen some people do that from a technical standpoint. So what's your name, just to give you some standing up and asking question love, which we totally appreciate.
Jared.
Awesome. And what's your question?
We talk about content changing on the fly based on people's reactions, and it doesn't really sound like, you know, people are giving their permission. I mean, Google's having a hard time just with their consolidating their privacy policy. I mean, what kind of implications do you think that has for privacy and people's rights in the future, you know, with that?
I think it's a huge issue, and so I think, you know, that there's going to be a lot of debate around that. But I just based on what I see in terms of some of the younger generation and their how they, you know, in terms of the social media and how much information they're willing to put out there, I think there's going to be a large sector that are going to be willing to say, sure, you know, if I get extra bonus points or I'm part of some social group, yeah, you can read my expressions and you can take back all that information and use that to, you know, to filter and the video that's coming to me. There will be a sector of people that say, no, that freaks me out, I'm not going to do that. But, I mean, we already know what's going on with Google and the searches and Facebook, and there's still a lot of people throwing a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah, and I can respond. I mean, Facebook's facial recognition technology, I didn't realize how thorough it was. Last year, I lost my password, and I was signing back in, and it had it showed me 16 different photos and said, is this your friend? And had boxes around the faces. And I was startled by how many pictures weren't ones that I'd put up with my friends in there. And I didn't give permission for any of that. But anyway, that's a great question. Thank you very much. And there's someone behind you. So what's your name and your question?
Hi, I'm Will. I'm like a documentary filmmaker, TV producer, and like to work on branded content because that helps pay the bills. But my question is, and I don't want to jump too far into a critical territory, but I mean, I want to briefly mention this Kony video that's, blowing up on Twitter and the divided reaction that that's getting. There's definitely a very large kind of slick white guys producing this, and he's getting his blonde kid to help tell this story, and it's very well done and very slick, and it's kind of, in my mind, a very documentary style branded film, although it's not necessarily for a brand. So I kind of want to transition that over into is things getting muddy and washed out when we're talking about documentary brand films and things like, I won't list a specific brand, but brand X hires a documentary filmmaker to go out and make these videos, and then they can be like, well, we don't like these. Let's change that story. So I guess and that's a lot of rambling, but my question is how do you react to that as a creative? And do you go into that, go into it with that in mind, knowing that that's a possibility?
Yeah, I think you have to be aware that there's kind of fundamentally this conflict of interest in that the person who's paying you to, who's funding the film, is also in some way a subject of the film. I think one of the things that we've tried to do in our case is really continue to position ourselves as filmmakers rather than advertisers. And we've continued to make our own films. And what that allows us to do, we hope, is push back a little harder when we hear things like, we don't like that. We can kind of, put our scarf on and get on our high horse about creativity and what have you. And then I think the other thing that you really have to do if you're coming from the creative standpoint is establish up front what generally is the story here. You don't want to be surprised in post-production when you've already shot and they come in and say, I don't like this story. I mean, it's documentary, so there's spontaneity, but even, in a purely creative doc, you go in with some general idea of the story you want to tell. So I think that the place where you make that choice is in what projects you choose, who you choose to work with, and we've certainly, had to turn down jobs because we thought that we would have to tell a story that wasn't as true as we would like it to be. And that's hard because that's usually when the money's best. But I think that's when you make the choice. You make the choice up front, what are they doing? Is it really something compelling? And this isn't necessarily just cause. This could be a company's purpose. What do they fundamentally do as a company and bring into the world? And is that valuable? And then you just work with them a lot up front to establish, okay, well, we know we're going to talk to these people, and we don't know exactly what they're going to say, but generally, what is the story here? Because you're right, you're in a real bad spot if they come through at the end and you're in post-production, you've already shot.
And Matt, I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off just so we have time. No, I mean, just so we watch the film, because we've got the 5 minutes. So this is your film, people. Thank you for your help.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Unfollowing, how being a jerk on Twitter can help you market your movie.
I want to start by saying my appearance here today is sponsored by Doritos in association with Staples and your local Beef Council.
You want to find the next big thing?
Everyone is a film watcher. Everyone is a film maker. Ultimately, we are all watchmakers.
I like that a lot. Can you post that on Facebook? So I can like it.
What it leads me to want to say is something that I might have to formulate it as I'm hearing your next response to what I'm proposing right now.
My life doesn't have a plot, so neither do my films.
I've been in every Asian market in the past 6 months, and they're telling a very different story.
Come on, everybody.
4K is the new HD.
7 is the new 30.
Standing is the new sitting.
And the great thing is, you never have to leave your house.
I'm going to shoot the whole thing on iPhones and then have children paint over it with their fingers.
Sliding under that previous point.
To break dance off of what you just said.
Skydive into what you're talking about, David.
It all comes down to the semiotics of hashtags.
Pinterest?
Ideation.
Super 8.
What
it's called. You're number 559. You're in a line.
I just became mayor of this panel. That's so 2011.
Well, that's so February 2012 to say that.
You're living in a typewriter world. I'm living in a world of Warcraft.
Exactly. And that's why I think the pager is coming back.
The next Steve Jobs is probably sitting in this room.
Probably at this table.
Probably in my chair.
Nice. Well done.
Good.
Guys, just really quick, can we have your name and the URL where people can find you again? And we'll start with you at the end there, Mark.
My name is Mark Hillman, and resource, www.resource.com.
My name is Matt Naylor, and our Twitter handle is at FlowNonFiction. And also, I should say, that shit panelists say for the rest of the week, you might hear some more things that are worthy of that. So keep us honest. We say a lot of ridiculous stuff. So for the rest of the week, if you hear something particularly jargony or stupid, shit panel, hashtag shit. Okay.
Brian Mochizuki with the Clinton Global Initiative, which has the easiest URL to type in the world, clintonglobalinitiative.org. We get like people mess up our emails on a regular basis because our email address is 40 characters. But.
Nice. Well,
I'm Sally Dobb. It's VIXS website. It's just VIXS.com. And you can also send me on Twitter. It's just Sally Dobb.
John Havens, our website is yoxi.tv. And by the way, thank you for mentioning the Kony video. I hadn't seen that till this morning. I'm a dad. If you guys don't know that video about in Uganda, this idea of the invisible children, it's incredibly powerful. And I think for me, a lot of this crowdsourcing thing is you have to watch it to be part of the conversation, right? And so a lot of what we're talking about here is if you agree with it, don't agree with it, think it's slick, and maybe it's pejorative slick, or maybe it's a good slick. If you watch especially, please do watch that video, because a lot of that is the idea, at least what I took from it, a lot of it's the idea of, I don't really care what you think about what I'm saying if these kids get saved. So it's a very powerful thing to watch. So anyway, a little impassioned plea at the end. Thank you very much for coming. Really, really appreciate your time.
One thing, we're uploading that to YouTube right now, and so if you check back at flownonfiction.com/shitpanelistsay in the next 15, 20 minutes, you'll see it there.
So again, so flownonfiction.com/shitpanelistsay.
That's right.
Awesome. And thank you again to our editor. Let's give it up for our editor doing that.
Yeah.